Thanks for dialing in to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. This is John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Each week we talk to Tom Gimbel. Is it each week that we talk to Tom Gimbel? Yeah, every week we talk to Tom Gimbel. Is it always on Tuesdays? Be nice if
always
I was,
on Tuesdays.
I should know this, what with me being the guy that talks to you every Tuesday. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
Pretty good, although here is my quip before we put you on the show today. I know you wanted to talk about what the class of 2022 wants, and I said, well, who's asking? But that's because those of us who are of a certain age, and by that I mean over the age of 30, never had an employer, especially when we graduated, ask us what do we want. It was more up to us to find out what do they want, and then we had to sort of provide. So what are you talking about here, Tom?
Well, it's a very good point, John. The fact is, it's become a situation in a low unemployment market that employers have to brand themselves, and they have to make people want to work there. Whether you need one person or you need 1,000 people, companies have to make it an attractive place to work. And that's been going on for forever. It just used to be more basic. The bigger the company everybody knew about, and there used to be a sense of that's where young people, anybody really, wanted to go work because it was job security. In this day and age, the idea of the small company and the startup is very attractive to people, especially recent college graduates. So it's become, how do we market ourselves? And the best way to do that is to know what the people coming out of college want.
And what do they want?
Well, that's a very good situation, or a very good question. They all have, the majority of them have had internships. The majority of them are using job boards. But what they want is medical coverage, which is almost what every company's offering. So that's really pushed down from parents that are saying, hey, listen, when you're 26, you have to come off mine anyway, so you better make sure you get one. And then the number two one has been a 401k match. So more and more employees and kids out of college are starting to think about retirement early on and what am I getting from a company. But it's really less the benefits and more the perks. And what they're saying today is we want flexible hours to work when we want to work. We want to have remote work to be able to work from other locations. And then they want to know what the perks are, which that really hasn't changed over the past decade.
I guess everybody wanted to know what the perks were, but once upon a time, there weren't that many of them, especially for newbies. Are companies providing perks, incentives to these potential employees?
Well, that's the challenge the companies are facing now with remote work. And with hybrid work, is what used to be catered lunches or breakfasts or freebies in the office. You can't do that if people aren't coming into the office. It would be, you know, obviously not cost advantageous for a company to be sending things to people's homes for all their thousands of employees. And then you have the situation of it's starting to turn a little bit, John, that employers are saying you can't eat your cake and have it too. And you've got to make a decision. If you're going to be in the office, we want to do things for our employees beyond benefits, which would be obviously perks. However, if you're never coming in or it's going to be very seldom, then we just can't, it doesn't make sense to do those things. You're not buying in volume anymore.
Well, and maybe working from home is a perk unto itself. Do the new employees want that? Do these college graduates want to go into the office 5 days a week? I would think that would be not only desirable, but almost necessary.
Well, the majority of them want a hybrid. You know, the majority want to be able to do what they want when they want, and who of us doesn't want that? However, the companies are figuring out of when they have to lay down the law and when you give a lot of rope. And, you know, it's funny. I was talking to the CEO of a publicly traded company this morning, and what he said to me was, I've got a group of employees that came to me and said, we feel like we have to always be on now that we work remotely. And, you know, that's frustrating. And he said, well, don't work remotely. Come into the office and then you'll be able to feel like you turn it off. And they said, well, no, we don't want that.
well, then what can I do for you? Because
exactly right. You can't, you complain. I give you a solution. You say you don't like the solution. So you just want to complain, right? Yeah, you can't have everything your way.
Here's what I'm hearing, that you actually don't want to work. That's what you don't want to do. Or maybe you're afraid that you can't stop working. But the idea that when you go to work and you come home from work, you're not working anymore seems new again, doesn't it? That would solve that problem.
It does. The real question that people don't, you know, a lot of companies don't take people down this path, but I really believe it's crucial, is what do you want to accomplish professionally, and in what time frame do you want to accomplish that? And if you want to do it very, you know, you want to do that in a very short time frame, the question is, how much work are you going to do to achieve it? It's no different than if you're digging a ditch or planting a garden. If you only want to plant one flower a day, then your garden isn't going to look very good come July. But if you want to have it look really good by July, you've got to be planting a heck of a lot of flowers in June.
I want a lot of flowers. Well, you only planted two. You should plant more. Well, I don't want to do that. All right.
Exactly right. John, you're coming over to my side of the table. I like this. I like where this is going.
That's Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Click on thelasallenetwork.com. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, Tom.
Stay healthy, John.
Philip Weiss is joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. He's the president of Seyfarth at Work. Hi, Philip. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again, John.
I know you have on your mind mask shaming at work, but isn't that oh so 2 months ago? Why is this resonant now? I thought we were past that.
Yeah, it was oh so 2 months ago, and maybe oh so about a year ago. But it's a resurgence that we didn't really expect, and it's directly tied to the loosening of restrictions regarding masks in the workplace and generally. And what that leaves us with is people who feel they have to keep wearing masks, and others around them aren't always taking kindly to the sight of someone who is still masked up. We've seen ostracism of coworkers, ridiculing of coworkers, and worse. So it is unexpected. Hopefully it will abate, but it's definitely something clients are telling us about.
Well, once upon a time, the ire was directed at the people who wouldn't wear masks. Are you saying now there's some hostility or shade thrown at people who do wear masks?
Yes, it is a kind of flipping of the script. And what we're getting, John, is this an impression, some indications that people so desperately want COVID to be over and behind all of us that the sight of a colleague wearing a mask is a not so pleasant reminder that maybe it's not all gone. In fact, there are reports from workplaces that infections are spiking, but we don't have the data to back it up because the testing centers have closed. So we're in this kind of interesting netherworld where the infections might be there, the masks still exist for some people, and others don't like to see them.
So give me an example of what happens then.
Well, we've got the basic ostracism and avoidance of people wearing masks. We've got more overt stuff, John. Employees actually walking up to others and saying, you know, COVID is over, get over the mask. Or even worse, we've seen some ill-intentioned pranksters who've taken matters into their own hands at one company. A bunch of employees went over late at night to the basket of free masks that the company had placed out there for anyone's use, and added mini jars of baby food and pacifiers to the basket as a signal that, you know, you're a bunch of terrified infants, take off the masks.
Well, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, you know. Well, you know, people are creative when it comes to pranks. Maybe this is not the right moment to place the energy here.
So what are employers or managers doing about that?
Well, it's interesting. We've got a lot of CEOs telling us that the last 2 weeks, they've been encouraging people to feel comfortable to take off the masks, meaning masks are optional, don't feel obligated. And some of them have realized that served as a bit of a license to those who wanted to make trouble to kind of take it to their colleagues. In some cases, as a result, CEOs, CFOs who don't necessarily want to wear masks or feel it's necessary in their case are putting masks back on, at least on a periodic basis, and walk in the hallways. Some companies, John, have updated their dress codes to explicitly state that masks are an acceptable form of covering or clothing. So they're doing what they can to send a signal like, we're not expecting it. We know it's not required, at least at the moment. But everyone has the choice whether you do or don't wear a mask. You should be comfortable with that choice.
But it's seen as a little passive-aggressive to wear the mask in some circles now. Is that what you're saying?
So people who engage in the kind of the reactions in the responses. They sometimes believe that those who are wearing masks are doing it as a statement. Like they've even quoted politicians terms like COVID theater or COVID crisis actors without a crisis. What they don't realize is so many people who come to work might be immunocompromised, might have an elderly relative at home, perhaps are still suffering from long COVID. There are so many reasons people might mask up. We had one guy, John, who was he was an extensive traveler for the business, had been to a number of hot spots, and just wanted to protect his colleagues. So a lot of it is not making the assumption, but just respecting us and others in all directions, irrespective of the choice.
That's the irony, isn't it? Much of the mask wearing was done to protect other people as much as the person wearing the mask. At this radio station, Philip, we have some people who still wear the mask on occasion, sometimes in the office or sometimes in public, and then some who don't. And it is, in my mind, a medical statement more than it is a political one. I could see how it would be construed as one or both. But at the end of the day, you have to sort of respect that person's caution. I mean, what do you care if they're wearing a mask?
Your statement is one that really dovetails with what we've been hearing from a lot of corporate leaders. They are yearning to get to that point where we're actually used to seeing masks. COO said to me, it should be like someone wearing glasses. It's something they need or they feel they need, and it's not my business to talk about it either way. So you are quoting the executives right there.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, that 10 cents will get you a cup of coffee for me. I mean, sane as that sounds, you also have employees. I guess it's kind of a wake-up call, right? That, all right, we'll all not talk about the mask, but simmering underneath is that resentment or that divide. I mean, I guess it's a reminder to employers that your employees aren't all necessarily on the same page about a lot of things.
Yeah, that's an insight that I think is really telling. It's a reflection of the times we live in, where employees are quoting, if not the company CEO who maybe said it's okay not to wear masks, they're quoting politicians and those sound bites that tend to divide us as opposed to look for ways that we can support each other. And it's really interesting. One company, they try to get creative and try to take that a little bit of the wind out of that antagonism. They put up posters, John, that indicated anything that is an employee choice. And it could be what they eat for lunch. So they showed photos of the lunchbox. It could be how they get to work, the mode of transit, or it could be the mask. This is just another choice that we should make. We shouldn't overemphasize it. We should let it go, and we should respect others.
Philip Weiss is the president of SeyFarth at Work, SeyFarth, SeyFarthAtWork.com. Talk to you again soon. Thanks, Philip, for your time.
Thanks for having me, John.
Barty Scott joins us now, the senior editor, Economy, Business Insider. You can visit businessinsider.com. Thanks for joining us, Barty. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Good. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening with inflation and how people are reacting to it. First, give us the backdrop on this piece. What are you saying about what's happening with the economy generally?
So the main message of this piece is that the vibe around the conversation around the economy has shifted. The headline is basically that the economy is doing really well. We're recovering much faster than we did after the Great Recession. You know, I can list off all the reasons why, but basically the one big downside is inflation. And that has kind of spoiled the mood on the recovery.
And sort of spoiled, boy, maybe this is a political story, maybe it isn't, but that sure is hard for the president to get over. I mean, I'm sure there are days where Joe Biden is going, we beat the pandemic, everybody's got a job back, prices, wages are going up, and but for that damn inflation, I cannot buy a break here. To say nothing of what's happening in Ukraine, but I mean, this must be very frustrating for a president who wants to remind people that economically there are many good things.
Exactly. I mean, basically anyone in America who wants a job can get a job. And like you said, wages are rising, but inflation is almost canceling out that rise. And, you know, in the U.S., we by design have an economy that the president doesn't have a ton of control over. And especially when it comes to inflation, with the causes being the war in Ukraine, supply chain, short labor shortages and snafus. There's very little that Biden can do, but it definitely is hurting him in the polls.
And maybe I shouldn't minimize how important that is. That is, I don't care about all those other good things. If it costs me more to live than my new wages or my old wages, that's a very real predicament for people, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to discount the impact that that has.
Oh, absolutely. You know, experts can say all day that the economy is doing well, but if your rent is going up, your grocery bill is going up, it's much more expensive to fill your car with gas, then people aren't going to feel like the economy is good.
Right. I mean, it's almost an academic conversation then. I don't know what economy is good means. I know that gas is $4.50 a gallon. You talked to a Harvard economist who said that there is just a 20% chance of a recession this year. Now, what's the definition of a recession, and do other people agree with him?
So the definition of a recession is when the economy has stopped growing for two quarters or more. So the chances of that happening this year would mean it would have to start, you know, around the middle of the summer. And so a lot of economists are still saying there's like a pretty low chance that we're going to have a recession in 2022, including Jason Furman at Harvard. Like you said, he puts it at around a 20% chance. But, you know, there are some experts who are saying inflation is so bad and the Federal Reserve has started raising interest rates to fight that it could shoot us in the other direction and put us into a recession. But we don't want to raise alarm bells on that too much, because most people are still saying that the chances of it happening this year or even next year are still pretty low.
Was some of this inevitable? I mean, was this going to happen because of the amount of money we put into the economy during the pandemic and maybe the supply chain issues and maybe now the war in Ukraine? I mean, I wonder if those factors or whatever else I didn't mention were going to almost guarantee that you'd have at least this kind of inflation.
I think that the quick recovery, yes, has fueled the inflation. The other option, though, is a really slow recovery like what happened after the Great Recession, and people don't like that either. You know, at least now people can have a job. But like you said, with all the money coming into the economy, it also means people are spending a lot, which is tying up supply chain and, you know, causing businesses to raise prices to meet that demand.
I want to read the headline in your piece, though. Barty Scott's on the phone line, senior editor at Business Insider. There's a vibe shift happening in the economy as people freak out over inflation and a possible recession. That does make it sound as though the concern is worse than the fact, that we are worried too much about it, or we're overly concerned. Is that a fair interpretation of all of this?
I think we're overly concerned about the possibility of a recession. I think that to say that people are overreacting to inflation, like you said before, would be discounting the pain that some people are feeling every day. And that is a real concern.
Yeah, but it's also a real cudgel. It's a lever. It's an opportunity for Republicans to, as the election comes up, paint the Democrats as the architects of your pain. And I'm not sure how true all of that is. I think it's one of the reasons that you see in Chicago, the mayor, the governor, and the president of the United States all considering more checks in the mail for people, for gas or anything else, you know?
Right. We have seen some solutions in Chicago, like you said, of providing people with a free tank of gas, for example, or gas cards, or even suspending the tax on gas temporarily. It's called a gas tax holiday. Some yeah. politicians have floated that idea. Yeah. But it's really just a temporary solution. We have such bigger systemic problems that need to be addressed.
I think some of those politicians with those sorts of incentives are the ones that are freaking out. I think that makes it seem worse than it actually is. Once again, noting fully that it is painful for some people. I don't think it is as bad as people like me make it out to be sometimes. It's an interesting perspective from Barty Scott, senior editor over at Business Insider. Yeah, well done. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's 12:44. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Another high-profile space in Chicago may be nearing default. Cranes reports the $55 million loan on the two buildings at 545 and 555 North Michigan Avenue has been transferred to a special servicing firm that oversees problem mortgages. That's the building that once housed the Gap store, which closed in 2021. The move means the mortgage is in danger of default and may signal the property owner is seeking to restructure the debt. The vacancy rate on Mag Mile has jumped to 25%, which is more than double its 2018 level. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
With the business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah. Okay, here we are. It is National Deep Dish Pizza Day, or as we know it in Chicago, every day. And let's begin by getting to the bottom of who invented it. The history is a little murky, but one story credits Ike Sewell and Rick Ricardo as they were working at Pizzeria Uno nearly 80 years ago. There's another story, though, that says Rudy Malnati, who was also working there, invented it.
That's not really true.
Says Mark Malnati, the owner of Lou Malnati's Pizzerias. And before we finish the story of who created Deep Dish, where are you on the Malnati family pizza tree, Mark?
I'm pretty low-hanging fruit on the tree. My grandfather, Rudy, was in the business starting in the 40s. My dad came alongside him in the 50s, and I joined in 77.
Okay, so back to who invented Chicago-style deep dish pizza?
The creation of the product really goes to Rick Ricardo. He was the restaurant guy involved at the beginning, and he died very shortly after Uno opened. I think Ike Sewell took credit for it after that, but he was a liquor salesman and really didn't know his way around the kitchen very well.
Grandpa Rudy Malnati did, though.
He was a great cook, and he probably had a lot to do with the tweaking of the product and making it taste great.
And for the uninitiated, Mark, how would you describe deep dish pizza?
Boy, deep dish pizza is a blend of a beautiful, crispy yet buttery crust that's cooked in a pan that's been aged for years. And we pile mozzarella cheese from Wisconsin on, and then a layer of sausage. And then on top, big, juicy, sweet plum tomatoes that just explode the flavor in your mouth, and covered with a layer of herbs and a couple different cheeses. And when you get your first bite and you see that mozzarella just stretch out of the pan, it is something to behold.
Okay, then. My mouth is watering. Enjoy the holiday. Celebrate responsibly. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us once again. I'm trying to remember, Amy, so many restaurants closed. If I recall, that Rainforest Cafe downtown closed up shop a year ago or so. But I guess they're done and somebody else is moving into that spot, huh?
Yeah, potentially so. So when the Rainforest Cafe closed, it wasn't quite clear who was going to move into that spot. However, there is a cannabis business, according to some reporting from John Pletz at Crane's Chicago Business, that is looking to move into that space. And of course, everybody knows that building with the giant frog and the toadstools and stuff out front. You know, you can't help but notice that building in River North. So the issue at hand really is that there is a state law that cannabis dispensaries cannot be more than 1,500 feet apart. If it goes in there, and they have made an appeal to the zoning board, but if the facility does go in there, it appears anyway that there are two other facilities that are within 1,500 feet of it. But it would also, if it works out, it would certainly make that area of River North kind of this district with a lot of dispensary action right there. So I think it's something really interesting to watch, because not only where they're going in and how we've been kind of stumbling through that lottery process and how we've awarded licenses and all that, and that's still part of that remains to be seen, but also just in terms of how many cannabis companies are based here in Chicago. I think as they continue to grow, we've seen some acquisitions recently of them, some of these companies based here, buying out companies, smaller companies, just to get a share of other states, where we're kind of potentially seeing a bit of a hub of the cannabis industry here in Chicago.
That's a quarter of a mile, 1,500 feet. So I'm wondering what the wisdom of that was. Was it they didn't want to create a district of drugs, cannabis, or was it to sort of protect the economic viability of some of these businesses? You don't want a competitor across the street.
I think it's probably a bit of both. It's unclear, but in the when this law was getting debated and discussed before it was signed into law, there was a lot of conversation, kind of to both points, really. We don't necessarily want to make this district of everybody knows this block is the place, but we also don't want to have shortchange one business by putting a similar business so close to it. So. Mm-hmm. But it will be interesting because just of all that action right there in River North around this industry and the company that wants to move into there, Consume, they have a shop on the northwest side on Milwaukee Avenue already. So this would be relocating into River North.
That space is huge though, right? I mean,
it is.
That was a really big joint.
It's about 22,000 square feet, I believe, was in the reporting. It's a pretty big space. And I think it'll be interesting to see what goes on with the outside of it, of course, if this goes through.
That's a lot of pot. But actually, if they've got the toads and the frogs and the plants, a lot of people who consume marijuana kind of see that stuff anyway. So they'll be right at home. Maybe it won't be. They won't have to change anything. Elon Musk is still in the news over his designs on Twitter, huh?
That's exactly right. So yesterday we learned that he had bought a 9.2% stake in Twitter. Today, Twitter announced that he is joining the board. Part of the terms of him joining the board is that he has agreed he won't buy more than about 14.9% of company shares while on the board. The term will end in 2024. I think it'll be interesting to see what he does. You know, Parag Agrawal, the CEO of Twitter, has referred to him. He said he's both a passionate believer and an intense critic, but felt like he would bring a lot of value to it. Immediately, Elon Musk started polling other Twitter users and polling people on Twitter asking about an edit button, which is something people have asked for a very, very long time on Twitter that Twitter has resisted. So we'll see what influence he wields on the board.
Boy, if he fixes that, not the Twitter hasn't been able to survive the lack of an edit button, but the fact that they don't, and I know they have some reason for it, it's never made any sense to me. You got to put the tweet up, realize it's wrong, then take it down, then fix it. How about edit? Huh?
I know it never fails. You know, you send a really funny tweet and then you realize there's a typo in it, but three people have already retweeted it. And you're like, oh, do I leave the typo or do I delete it and write it again and not get these, you know, retweets, whatever. There's always kind of that push pull there. So we'll see what influence he has on the board and what changes he might help push through.
Morningstar is in the news.
That's right. So Morningstar, which of course is based here in Chicago, they have agreed to buy leveraged commentary and data from S&P Global for as much as $650 million in cash. So the deal is that they will pay $600 million at closing and then make an additional payment of $50 million about 6 months later if certain terms are met. LCD, as it's known, leveraged commentary and data, they're a data and news service provider. So that'll be an interesting to see what they pull together in there. And there's some reporting from Bloomberg that goes into depth a little bit more about kind of what that means. But LCD generates about $56 million in revenue and has about 60 employees. So this is an extra wing for Morningstar.
Amazon is buying Rockets because they've already bought everything else.
Because they've run out of everything else to buy. So sure, Rockets. This is actually a very big story, and it's been widely discussed on social media today. It's very interesting. So they announced that they are doing this deal with three different companies. They didn't put an exact price tag on it, but this is all part of their Project Kuiper. And that is the plan to launch these internet satellites into low orbit Earth. So they have done this deal. They are calling it the biggest rocket deal in commercial space history. They've signed with three companies for up to 83 launches of these internet satellites. Their plan is to put about 3,200, it's over 3,200 satellites into this orbit with the goal of high-speed internet just about anywhere in the world. The FCC already authorized this. They actually did it kind of earlier as the pandemic was starting to unfold here in the U.S. That's about at the time that authorization came through. And Amazon said they're going to invest more than $10 billion to build that. But it's it's a huge deal, even though we don't know exactly the price tag on it. It's a very, very big deal. I think to go back to Elon Musk, it'll be interesting to see his comment on this, because this is part of the aim of what SpaceX is doing, is pushing these low orbit satellites out with the same goal of high speed internet anywhere in the world. So these two will be in competition, but this is a very major step for Amazon. And there's CNBC and some other outlets have done some really in-depth reporting on kind of what that looks like and what these satellites mean and kind of the potential for what could be done with them.
That's Amy Guth. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.